This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Hey, we're watching what's going on with Omicron. Cases are spreading in China during the countdown to the Winter Olympics in Beijing, with a leading ski jumper pulling out after she tested positive. Our next guest, by the way, is an Olympian silver medalist winning at the Athens Games for swimming back in 2014.
We're talking about Tara Kirksell, senior scholar at the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Tara, it's great to speak with you again. I'm wondering about the Olympics happening in Beijing versus the Olympics that we saw in Tokyo. And these are both happening in the midst of a pandemic. Why is it so much more difficult for athletes in Beijing?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on the show. I think that the Tokyo Olympics proved that you can hold an Olympics during a pandemic, but the difficulty level is so much greater this time around for China. First, because we're dealing with the Omicron variant instead of the Delta variant. The Omicron variant is much more transmissible and seems to be able to have more breakthrough cases for people who are vaccinated. And then the second reason is because China has this zero COVID approach to COVID-19. And so the margin for error, there just really isn't a margin for error because they can't let it get out. They can't make any mistakes.
So do you think it was smart that they went ahead with the games?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they had some competing priorities, right? They want to be able to hold the games. They put a lot of investment into it. I think that, you know, it can be done. But at the same time, you know, it's very hard for them to do that and still push this COVID, the zero COVID approach. I mean, I think at some point they're going to have to say, you know, then what? What are we going to do? How are we going to move away from zero COVID? And I think that the games may be the start of how they're going to think about that.
So how should we watch it as spectators? How should we look at it as spectators and try to understand what these Olympians are going through? I mean, a big part of the Olympics, of course, is understanding the athletes, learning about their backstories. The experience that you had at the Olympics in Athens in 2004, that's got to be completely different than what these athletes are doing right now. It doesn't sound that fun to actually be an Olympian right now.
Well, I mean, the first thing that's most important to Olympians is to compete in their sport. And this is still, you know, even with sort of the fun drained out of, the partying and the, you know, gathering.
The camaraderie, right, about meeting so many people.
The camaraderie. Even with that drained out, I still do feel like you've trained all your life, or at least for the last 4 years, to, you know, compete on the world stage. And I think that still remains, and that's still valuable. And so I think that's why athletes are still trying to participate and still going through all the trouble of these tests and everything that they need to get to Beijing and to compete. I think it's still worth it, but you're right. There is something lost here.
So how do you feel like once we get through this? I wonder, I do think this is going to be with us for a long time, at least based on the conversations we have with you and your team at Johns Hopkins and others in the healthcare professions. I don't know. It sounds like we've learned a lot. We're ready for the next one. I don't know. How do you see it?
Well, I think when it comes to COVID-19, you're right. It's going to be with us for a long time. I think that for the most part, people who've been vaccinated have a really good protection against severe disease. So I think it's something that won't be sort of this front burner, emergency anymore. We'll probably see some surges in cases where you'd have to put a mask back on if the cases got really high, and you might worry about hospitals because, you know, there's some people who just won't get vaccinated who will end up in the hospital. But I think overall, we're just going to be dealing with it. Now, does that make us ready for the next one? I think that there's a question there because public health has lost a lot of trust. Mm-hmm. But people have lost a lot of trust in public health. And it's going to be the work of a generation of public health leaders to try to rebuild that.
Well,
because I think trust is the most important thing when it comes to pandemic response.
Well, how do they do that in this last phase of vaccine rollout for kids under the age of five? How does the federal government say that these shots are safe for the youngest?
Sure. Well, I think that it's providing the data so that people can look at it and feel confident in it. But I also think it's not the federal government that should be telling people, you know, like, here's what you should do. I think it's really about helping people have these conversations with people they trust. I mean, you either trust the government or you don't, and we're not going to be able to change that in the next, you know, few months. So I think that really it's about, you know, Johns Hopkins has, you know, published a new how to talk to, you know, vaccine ambassador training to how to talk to parents about vaccinating their kids, right? These types of conversations that happen, you know, on the sidelines of sports events, on the bleachers at a swim meet, you know,
right,
or, you know, amongst other parents, people they trust at church, those types of things. That's where we sort of will make these gains. I don't think it's, you know, having someone from the CDC coming out saying anything.
All right, we got to run.
These conversations.
Hey, Tara, thank you, Tara Kirksell. She's senior scholar at the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, joining us on the phone from Washington. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
I want to get to this week's cover story. Back in June of last year, Hong Kong authorities shutting down Apple Daily. It was a popular newspaper aligned with the city's democracy movement. It's become clear that China's attack on the publisher was really a template for a broader crackdown when it comes to Hong Kong and democracy in Hong Kong.
This story is the cover of the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's available on newsstands on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. The story written by Ian Marlowe, Asia government senior reporter for Bloomberg News. He's with us now on the phone from Canada. Ian, this is congratulations on the cover, by the way. It's just a really, really important story and a really important topic. I wanted to start off with more about what Apple Daily is or was.
Yeah, thank you. No, Apple Daily was an enormously popular newspaper in Hong Kong. Just to give you a sense, there were roughly 3.8 million registered users on the website, which is roughly half the city's population. And just before they were shut down, they had more than 600,000 paying digital subscribers. So very popular. It was a huge source of news, but it was also at the heart, to some extent, of the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong. It was owned by Jimmy Lai, a very wealthy tycoon in Hong Kong, who, unlike the other, establishment figures in that city, was willing to use his resources, his financial firepower, to push back against China, to push back against what they were doing in Hong Kong with regard to pushing the national security law through, jailing all these pro-democracy advocates and those sorts of things. So he was a prime target, not just for the local Hong Kong government, but for Beijing more broadly. And they had singled him out numerous times, for being a sort of rabble-rouser in Hong Kong. And when the government went after his paper, they really went after it. They froze the bank accounts. They arrested the top staff. There were 500 police officers sent to raid the headquarters in Hong Kong. This was unprecedented in a city that is not just a global financial center, but was also a sort of regional base for international media companies, you know, from Bloomberg to CNN to others. So it was the shutdown was a shock, but it was also, to a large degree, a template for what Beijing wanted to do with Hong Kong in the future. And since it was shut, things have only accelerated further.
You know, Ian, I think about, I worked at the Wall Street Journal on a broadcast called the Wall Street Journal Report. And I mean, Hong Kong was this safe zone, right? And, you know, when it came to business, markets, you name it, and everybody kind of looked to Hong Kong as maybe a sign of what was hopefully to come more broadly in China. And now we're finding out that that's not the case. By targeting Apple Daily, right? It could have targeted, you know, a lot of things initially, but by really going aggressively after Apple Daily, that tells you what?
Yeah, I mean, it basically tells you that, like in mainland China, there is just zero tolerance for anything that could represent an alternate power center in Hong Kong. And systematically, bit by bit, the government has gone after the opposition politicians in Hong Kong, those democracy advocates who were actually working within the system. They went after Apple Daily, right off the bat, closed that. That was a huge source of opposition support. Then they started going after smaller targets. They started going after charities, NGOs, some of the organizations that had, promoted some of the peaceful protests over the past 20 years, and that basically one by one sort of dismantled anything that could represent any threat at all to China getting its way in Hong Kong, and Apple Daily was absolutely, without any doubt, it was the biggest one there. And I think that the big thing about Apple Daily's closure was, what happened, everyone was saying, well, who's next? And I don't think anyone's really even asking that question anymore, because everything that's happening, people guessed from the outset of the national security law being put down in June 2020, that basically gone after anything that represents memorials to the Tiananmen Square, anyone that was agitating in a labor union, all those sorts of things, bit by bit. And now, even just this week, we saw the University of Hong Kong, which is one of the most prestigious universities in the city, just had a visa rejected for a researcher who was meant to come into the city just to do research on LGBTQ rights. And so it's sort of a endless procession here where, anything can be considered somewhat anti-establishment if the authorities really feel like it's a threat to them. So, and the other thing here is that Apple Daily was a business. It was owned by a publicly listed company. Jimmy Lai had 71% of the shares in that company. He was overruled, and there was a government order for him not to exercise his voting rights. And then the government froze the accounts without any resource to the courts, and the company was shut down. So that's something that I think a lot of people in Hong Kong are concerned about, because essentially the sky's the limit now in terms of what the government can use this law for. And they're putting it into every piece of legislation they can, from film censorship laws to tax guidance for charities. It's all over the place. This language about national security and acting contrary to the interests of national security, it's all very vague. And I think people just actually now kind of know which way the slide is going here.
Well, it's a must read. It's the cover story of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. And we really appreciate catching up with Bloomberg News Asia Government Senior Reporter Ian Marlowe.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so how's your day going? Not so great if you are Meta Platforms, also known as Facebook. Company shares experiencing a one-day crash that may rank as the worst in stock market history, Tim.
Yeah, Mark Zuckerberg losing some $30 billion in net worth as well with a stock plunge like this.
It's like unbelievable. And we've seen a great story on the Bloomberg, Naomi Nix putting it out, about Mark Zuckerberg actually talking to his employees. Let's get more from Bloomberg News tech team leader Sarah Fry. She too has an interesting column that's out. She's on the phone from San Francisco. She knows this company so, so well. She's the author of No Filter, the inside story of Instagram.
Sarah Fryer, it is great to have you back with us. I remember from reading your book close to a couple of years ago, the book about Instagram, No Filter, the inside story of Instagram, that Mark Zuckerberg is so paranoid about competition. How do you think he's feeling right now, seeing that Facebook user growth has stalled and that TikTok is a real competitor where people are spending, especially young people, a lot of time?
I mean, this is his deep fear that he's had at the, one of the reasons that Facebook has continued to grow for so long is because of Zuckerberg's paranoia. The growth team that he has basically monitoring every possible reason that people could have to leave Facebook and trying to fix that as soon as possible. And one of the reasons for that is the network effect, the thing that made Facebook so powerful, the fact that if somebody uses one network, other people are more likely to use it. It has also a cascading negative effect. If people leave a network, it suddenly becomes less valuable for the remaining users. And so Zuckerberg never wanted Facebook to reach the point where it gets into a death spiral. And this could be that point. So I think it's very concerning to people at Meta. And I think that's why they're putting all their eggs in the metaverse basket.
So Facebook saw this coming because of what it sees in the internal data, and perhaps because of the pivot that it announced a few months ago of going into the metaverse. You've covered Facebook for years. Is this the most pivotal point that you've seen for the company from a business perspective?
I think so. I mean, I think I think, listen, they don't have a lot of options. In the past, maybe they could have acquired a great upstart social network to breathe new life into Facebook. You know, they can't make that kind of acquisition right now because of antitrust pressure. They could, you know, pull some levers to get people to share more, but they've already done that. So I think it's really hard for them, especially when you consider that their ad targeting is going to become less useful. It's going to be less easy for them to tell advertisers how well their ads performed because of Apple changes to tracking, asking users to agree to tracking, and a lot of users are saying, no, don't track me. So this is a time where you're seeing multiple existential threats to Facebook's business model, and their way out of it, the short-term way out is their TikTok copycat product, which is Reels, which, you know, it could work. I mean, YouTube Shorts is also a TikTok copycat product that's done pretty well, and maybe Reels could too. I haven't seen a lot there, but it looks to me like a lot of the stuff is reposted from TikTok, so there's that. And then there's the metaverse bet. The latter is something that, you know, requires all of us to want to live and work in a virtual world, which is going to be, it's kind of a pie in the sky dream.
I'm not ready to leave the real world. I'm just going to put it out there. Hey, having said that, we just were talking about the markets, and we're talking about Meta, Facebook, with our TV colleagues, and Romain Bostic bringing up that, you know, maybe it's time that Mark Zuckerberg steps aside running the company. Maybe there needs to be some new people coming in. We've seen this at a lot of these, whether it was Google. I think about when Eric Schmidt came in. You see this sometimes changing where the founder steps away for a moment. Is that something that we need to be thinking about or should be?
It depends how bad this gets. We've seen Zuckerberg pull up from a downturn before. I'm sure some employees are looking at this and thinking it's a great buying opportunity. It does seem pretty existential. That said, who else is going to be the one to drive this path into the metaverse? There is so much money invested of more than $3 billion in operating loss this past quarter that there's no turning back. They've put all the resources into play there, and if he's got the vision, like, this is, he's really the guy that's going to have to pull it through, I would expect. And so that makes things a little complicated. But the money makers are really Facebook and Instagram.
Sarah, you're sitting down with Mark Zuckerberg right now. I've got about 40 seconds left here. What do you ask him?
I just want to know if he really thinks that that they can afford to put products like Facebook and Instagram into a sort of maintenance mode, like sort of change the focus of the metaverse. It seems like there's still so much to fix on those products, and I just wonder if that's going to hurt them long term, that they're not focused on solving the problems with their existing networks and instead focus on the future effort.
All right, going to run. Sarah, thank you. Sarah Fryer, big tech team leader, Bloomberg News. Check out her book if you haven't read it already, No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. Facebook shares right now, Tim, down 27%.
Worst day in the company's history by far.
And talk about a haircut on that market cap.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just 1 week from now, Tim and I are going to be out in sunny LA just ahead of the Super Bowl and at the Bloomberg Power Player Summit. It's a gathering of who's who in sports, including NFL team owners, players of all sports, agents, broadcasters, and so much more. No doubt we will be talking about the explosive lawsuit filed by former Miami Dolphins head coach Brian Flores. So let's get some reporting on this and what the owner of the Dolphins is now saying. With us right now is Bloomberg News legal reporter Chris Dolmetsch. She's on the phone from Manhattan Federal Courthouse. Hey, Chris, nice to have you here with Tim and myself. So what is the owner talking about? We're talking about Stephen Ross.
Yeah, so Mr. Ross is vehemently denying the allegations in the lawsuit, most substantially the allegation that he offered Brian Flores $100,000 per game to lose, basically to tank, so that the team would have a worse record and have a better shot at one of the top draft picks. He's saying he never made these. He welcomes the NFL's investigation, and he's promising to fight these allegations.
In the lawsuit, Flores does allege that his refusal to tank games led to a clash with Stephen Ross, who was mad that the team won 5 games that season, costing them a chance at the top overall draft pick. I mean, Chris, first of all, these are big allegations. It's interesting. I've seen an interview with Brian Flores on CBS. I mean, to come out, you know, when he was potentially up for maybe other jobs at other teams, I mean, these are big allegations to make.
They're huge. And I mean, you know, as he said himself, he's, you know, this is a huge professional risk. He doesn't really expect to work in the NFL anymore after this. So, you know, for whether or not the lawsuit goes anywhere, there's a lot of variables. It's a class action suit. He has to certify a class in order to proceed that way. There'll be, you know, years of arguments, at least months of arguments, dismissal motions, things like that. But whether or not this goes anywhere, this lawsuit is a huge shot across the bow of the NFL. Whether it succeeds or not, this is an issue that has been plaguing the league for decades, and they've been, you know, accused of not hiring black coaches. That's the whole reason the Rooney Rule is.
And that's the big part of his lawsuit, right?
Correct. The Rooney Rule is a sham. That it's really not. It doesn't do anything because they don't actually hire black coaches. They just interview them. He says he, you know, got a sham interview with the Denver Broncos 2 years ago.
Yeah. And so, Chris, as you note, the Giants, Dolphins, and Denver Broncos are all co-defendants in the lawsuit. So you mentioned, Chris, that it doesn't matter whether this lawsuit goes anywhere and it could drag on for years. What could the implications be for the NFL?
Well, certainly, you know, there could be some sort of settlement, you know, where the NFL kind of agrees to make some sort of changes in its, you know, in its functions and the way the Rooney Rule or enforces it, you know, to try to make some improvements. But that's just assuming there's a settlement and it doesn't go to court. I mean, that could take a long time. We'll see what happens. But the implications for the NFL legally are a lot less probably important than really just, you know, in terms of its fan base, its perception, its image. And 2 weeks, like you guys said, the Super Bowl is coming up. You guys will both be there. It's going to be a huge topic of conversation. The NFL would prefer that this stick about the Rams, you know, and the I forgot the other teams. But,
the Bengals?
Don't forget the Bengals. Bengals. My wife is going to be very, very angry, Chris.
She will be. She should be mad at me. All Cincinnati people should be mad at me.
I got to say, all the playoff games, it's easy to be like, wait, who finally won it? Because it was such a toss-up in those playoffs. Hey, Chris, just 20 seconds left here. Does he have to get, though, other members for this to ultimately become that class action and have some bite real quickly?
He does, but he, you know, his lawyer, Doug Wigdor, said that he has other people ready to sign on. Others have said they have coaches that can kind of similarly, you know, prove these same allegations. So there's a good chance he could get other people in here. Whether he'll get a class, different story.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch. Chris Dolmetsch, legal reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from the Manhattan Federal Courthouse.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we've got just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. It's been another wild week. We are at lows of the session. You just heard that from Charlie Pellett. And, of course, we've been talking about the tech sell-off, largely those disappointing results from Facebook owner Meta Platforms. Also some concerns about persistently high inflation from the ECB that continues to weigh on the markets.
Let's get some thoughts from Tom Plum, President and Chief Investment Officer at Plum Funds. Tom joins us once again on the phone from Madison, Wisconsin. Tom, we are really pleased to have you on a day like today. When you take a look at the way that Meta Platforms is just reverberating throughout the market, especially the NASDAQ 100, other social media companies like Snap, Pinterest, Twitter, and more, how do you try to understand what the role of one company can be on all these other companies? One bad result.
Well, Tim and Carol, it's great
result.
To be here even on a day like this. But you know what, in the market, what we always used to talk about is the second derivative, the rate of growth of the rate of growth. And when you see companies, even great companies like Facebook and PayPal and those companies, show a moderation in their growth rate or a decline in their rate, typically that's when the stock market starts to punish them. And we've seen that on some of the companies, but of course other ones like Microsoft and showed the opposite. So I think right now it's really key to be focusing on those companies that continue to show acceleration in this market environment. And some of them we'll see tonight if Amazon, for example, reports that the cloud AWS is growing strong enough to continue to show an acceleration, or if we're going to see some moderation because of the retail issues that we saw in some of these other companies.
Hey, Tom, we love talking with you. Your Plum Balance Fund in the 90th percentile for the past 5 years based on our data, meaning you beat just about all of the other funds in the category, returning on average annually nearly 12%. You don't own Facebook. I think I looked through the holdings and I did not see it. Why?
Well, we didn't own Facebook because we were thinking that there'd be significant competition at some point. And for much of this run, of course, we missed it. So I can't take a lot of credit for the fact that we missed today because we did miss the run-up of the previous years. But we have been concerned about the sustainability, the fact that they are in the political target of governments, and that there was going to be a lot of uncertainty about what their next thing would be.
Hey, Tom, I want to go to Amazon because they're reporting after the bell today, and you did mention them, but they are among the bigger holdings that you have in Plum Funds, accounting for more than 2.7% of the holdings, about $3.5 million worth of shares. Amazon shares down about a quarter since July 8th of 2021. What do we need to see from Amazon to get back to where it was?
Well, Amazon is, you know, obviously when you've been as successful as they have, they have to continually come up with something new. And the, you know, the cloud AWS, if they match Microsoft's numbers there showing, you know, 35% plus growth in that area, that would be something that would be very, you know, I think very big good news, and continue to say that they are finding the next big thing. It's really a question of how much is going to be on online sales versus, you know, what PayPal and those were saying is that there's a lot more people going into the stores. But I can tell you, I think Amazon is ingrained. It will continue to grow. It's just the question of the growth rate.
Where would you be allocating new money? Because we have seen when the equity market sells off, Tom, we have seen dip buyers. It maybe took a while, but they did come back. And we've seen some rallies off of those losses. Where would you be buying? Where would you be putting new money to work?
Hey, Carol, that's a great question because, you know, opportunities don't come because the market is hitting new highs. They come when, you know, the old cliche, when they throw the baby out with the bathwater. And there's some very good companies that are continuing to show some acceleration that we think are good places to invest when this market gives you this opportunity. One of them, of course, is a MasterCard, which is our largest holding in the Plum Funds, where we look at a company that has a 45% net profit margin. They've got crypto patents. They are recovering business in both business travel and expense, consumer travel, cross-border transactions, and addressing the huge business-to-business market, which is maybe five times as large as the consumer-to-business market.
Right, and who recently reported earnings along with Visa, and both of them really some eye-popping numbers when it comes to spending on their platforms.
Hey, Tom, where else are you guys deploying cash right now?
Well, there's a couple of smaller, you know, one of the things that happened since the summer is a lot of the small emerging technology companies, especially in that software area, had been really punished. And one of them is a little company called Latch, which is what we call the type of company that has hardware-enabled software. And here we think that they're basically the company that allows access and control over entry into apartment buildings. There are probably about 30% of the new apartment buildings. A small emerging company, but it's got probably a backlog that's almost eight times larger than their current sales. And so we're looking for a company, again, that's accelerating, maybe more than tripling their sales next year and even doubling it the following year.
All right. And one other name, we have just about 30, 40 seconds left.
Oh, we like this company called Olo, and every one of us who's been in that fast food line.
Oh, we've talked about this one.
That you can order ahead. And this is a company that's providing the software for a lot of the medium-sized chains like Denny's and Portillo's and Shake Shack, making it work so that labor can be used so much more effectively.
Bit beaten up. It's down about 21% this year, as we've seen a lot of these names under pressure. Tom Plum, be well. Good to check in with you. Tom Plum, he's President and Chief Investment Officer over at Plum Funds, on the phone from Madison, Wisconsin.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.